From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Where are the great American inventors of the 21st century? The next Thomas Edison, or Henry Ford, or Steve Jobs? Oh, sure, the internet's full of startups, but did you know that Americans today invent less than half of what we did a century ago? Half? Why? So first, if we're going to talk about invention in the U.S., we need to talk with Nathan Myhrvold. He was Microsoft's first chief technology officer. He holds 17 patents with Microsoft and 117 with his company Intellectual Ventures. But he's not just a billionaire tech nerd. He's also explored the world's volcanoes, studied penguin digestion, found several T-Rexes, built a section of Babbage's Difference engine. He's even the world barbecue grand champion. And Strange Champs caught up with Myhrvold to talk about inventing and his six-volume, 2,400-page, 52-pound cookbook called Modernist Cuisine.
You know, what I really love about this approach to cooking is that it seems to me it brings a sense of wonder back to food. I mean, people who are interested in food and cooking, after a while, if you've amassed a certain library of cookbooks, you do kind of get to the point where you feel like, yeah, you know, I've cooked everything, or not everything, but I've cooked sort of all the basics. This makes it all seem like brand new territory all over
and,
again.
You know, that is such a great comment, because that's exactly what it's about. It's about finding wonder and fun and novelty in food. You know, people love variety in what they eat. 30 years ago, it was hard to find sushi. These days, you can find sushi in probably every shopping mall in the United States and likely the world. Now, sushi seemed like a very strange thing initially. You know, raw fish and vinegared rice, what's up with that? But in fact, a lot of people have come to love it. And it's part of the diversity of things we have. Well, going forward, some of the diversity of our food is going to come from inventing new things, not just importing something. You know, sushi was an imported food. The people in Japan had made it for 1,000 years, so we just got to import it and enjoy it. We also get the opportunity to invent new foods. And of course, through history, people have. Ice cream was an invention, and I must say a very good one. So is pizza, so is bread, so is wine, so is cheese. Almost all of every aspect of cooking has got some really invented food. And I mean invented in the sense that, you know, an apple isn't invented. It grows wild. Farmers have done a lot of work to develop tastier versions of apples. But an apple you eat pretty much au naturel. The same thing is true of lots of other foods, but not ice cream, not pasta, not pizza, not wine. Those things are inventions. And I think going forward, we have an opportunity to invent lots of more things. And exactly what you said, bring a sense of wonder and fun and excitement to dining that you don't get if it's just same old, same old.
Does it translate to ordinary food too? You know, I made scrambled eggs for breakfast this morning. Would the modernist cooking techniques help me scramble my egg any differently?
One of my favorite recipes in the whole book is our scrambled eggs recipe, and I make it for myself 3 times a week. Now, there's 2 tricks in our scrambled eggs recipe, one of which you need some equipment to do, but I'll tell you one that you can use when you next time you make scrambled eggs. It's really simple. If you're making a 3-egg batch of scrambled eggs, make it out of 2 whole eggs and 1 egg yolk. So that means out of the 3 eggs, you're going to throw 1 egg white away. Now, why do that? Well, it turns out that the texture of the egg and the flavor of the egg is strongly influenced by the ratio of yolk to white. And just by throwing 1 egg white away, it's richer, it's creamier, it's softer textured, it's more yellow, it tastes more like egg. So give that a try.
My kids are going to love you. Sounds great. Now, I want to talk some about the whole process of invention, of coming up with new things. You know, we talked about it being connected to wonder. But when you're just sitting around, you know, you're coming up with a new recipe or tinkering or whatever, how does that process work for you? What's an example of the kind of question that might come to your mind?
I think if you talked to a bunch of inventors or innovators, you'd find that ideas come from all kinds of places or from nowhere. You know, it's one of the great mysteries of where do creative new ideas come from. And often you can draw a particular, you can say, oh, there's a source of inspiration. You know, happy accidents are one of the great sources of invention. You screw around with stuff, you try some things, something unexpected happens. So some of the ideas that we have in the cookbook happen that way, either to us or to other chefs who discovered it, told us about it, and we put it in the book.
Well, I asked that question because, you know, there have been a spate of articles and books lately about the decline of American innovation. And I'm wondering if, from where you sit, do you think American innovation is in decline? Are we inventing less than we used to?
Well, an amazing thing about America is that America started being the world's leading inventing company, or country, excuse me, in the 19th century. So you had the cotton gin, you had the telegraph, the telephone, you had all the wonderful things Edison did. But in the 19th century, America was an agricultural nation. We were the third world back then. What I mean is, it was a largely agricultural, rural country. We had a few big cities. We had a little bit of industry going on, but not that much in the 19th century. We had huge social problems in this country. We had massive corruption in, you know, New York City, Tammany Hall. If you saw Gangs in New York, it's about that. Mm-hmm. We had a brutal civil war. But somehow, the American spirit of innovation, which partially had been channeled into exploring the frontier, part of that spirit of innovation got channeled into coming up with new ideas. And America has been a fantastic inventor since then. So I don't think it's declining. I think, in fact, it's about to enter a new golden era. And you can see that in what's going on in Silicon Valley. You can see that in the creativity that is happening in startups and just new ideas all over the place.
I have to call you out on that. There was a fairly significant Freudian slip you made there earlier when you referred to the great American company, not country. That's exactly what a lot of people would say is wrong with or is in the way of American innovation, is that we have become the great American company.
Well, you know, I will agree with you in part that really wild innovation only rarely comes from companies, or big companies anyway. Really wild ideas come from an individual or a small group of individuals. And so if you look at really great inventions, look at the airplane that Orville and Wilbur Wright developed. They were not part of the R&D department of a railroad company where they said, I know, we'll have a better way to screw putting the railroad lines down. Let's fly.
Well, I asked you this because, you know, in addition to working on gorgeous modernist cuisine, you also have a company, Intellectual Ventures. This is a company that buys patents from small inventors and startups. And at this point, your company
and
is
big
amassed...
companies too.
But at this point, you've amassed one of the largest patent portfolios in the world. And you and your company have been vilified for this. You've been called a patent troll frequently. And the suggestion being that what you're doing is actually hindering the development of small inventions.
So here's the thing. If you come up with a new idea that's a really powerful new idea, somebody's going to find it threatening. And I think that's pretty much true no matter what area you're in. If you upset the apple cart, there's some entrenched player who says, you know, this could be bad for me. Or they don't understand it fully. And so if you look throughout history, lots of big, powerful ideas were vilified early on. In this case, the people who are critics, I think, don't really understand what we do, which is we are trying to create a market for invention, and we're trying to allow inventors to get paid for their inventions. And the reality is there are some inventors that are both well-positioned personally and they have the interest and the resources that they can go commercialize their inventions. And if that's true, God bless them. They should go do it. But there's another set of folks that say, look, I'm a research scientist. I came up with this great idea. I'm not the guy to take it forward. Or the individual inventor, or even the large company. You know, we've bought patents from most of the Fortune 500. By the way, we also invent our own patents. We're one of the largest inventing organizations in the United States.
So what do you do with the patents you buy?
So we try to make them work. And there's a bunch of ways that you do that. One way is you create a new company. And so we've done that a few times. We've got a company that is developing an exciting new kind of nuclear power reactor. Because the world needs a carbon-free, clean energy source that's safe. And we think that this new reactor might be that. Now, it's a very daunting project. We've hired a whole bunch of the smartest nuclear engineers we can find. We're working with universities and national labs, and we're trying to make that thing work. You know, we've got a couple other things like that where we're creating a company. We also sell our patents to people sometimes because a company will say, look, I really need this patent. I need to own it for a bunch of reasons. So those are the ways we try to make money doing it. And frankly, we're better at doing that than the typical university or the typical independent individual inventor. Mm-hmm. Or even, strangely enough, we're better at this than a Fortune 500 company.
In the meantime, this subject raises hackles on both sides all over. It's incredibly complicated and beyond the scope of this interview. But I'm just curious, if you were going to scrap the entire patent system we have now, which certainly has received plenty of criticism, you know, if the president of the U.S. came to you and said, we want to jumpstart American innovation. We've always been a country of makers, and we're concerned that our current patent system is just not really working all that well. We want to get back to a situation in which everyone, small inventors, basement startups, and bigger companies, can flourish. Would that be possible?
Well, here's the problem. You know, my company has, one way or another, we've given about $300 million to individual inventors in the United States. That's royalties on their inventions, primarily. It's also some money we've given them up front to help develop inventions. Now, who else is going out there giving $300 million to individual inventors in the U.S.? And the only reason I'm able to do that, it's not because I'm a philanthropist. I'm able to do that because I have investors, and my investors want a return. And if you don't let me earn a return from my investors, they're going to stop investing this way. Meanwhile, if you do let me make a return, then I can create a new industry I call invention capital, very much like venture capital, where investors will say, hey, they'll fund other people, not just me, to do this. And we'll get billions of dollars a year channeled into helping inventors invent new things. Now, venture capital did that for entrepreneurs. And imagine America if venture capital hadn't created Microsoft, Apple, Cisco, Facebook, Google. Those companies have changed the world, and they've changed this country for the better because they've given enormous amounts of employment and wealth and economic opportunity, not only to their employees, but to everyone they do business with. Now, that's all because a bunch of crazy guys 30, 40 years ago in Silicon Valley had the idea, let's fund entrepreneurs. I have the crazy idea, let's fund inventors. And if we can fund a bunch of inventors to go do great new inventions, I think we can make our economy better, we can get unemployment down, and we can have a really sustainable source of value going into the remainder of the 21st century. Because unfortunately, the old things we used to be good at, the rest of the world's catching up at. We can't be the only great manufacturer, the only great agricultural power, because there's so many other countries that are developing. But invention is something that we have been so uniquely good at for, you know, more than 100 years now. I think we can take it forward into the next 100 years.
Nathan Myhrvold talking with Anne Strainchamps. Myhrvold was Microsoft's first chief technology officer. He holds 17 patents with Microsoft and 117 with his company, Intellectual Ventures. His cookbook, The Modernist Cuisine, won the 2012 James Beard Award. To see photos from his book, just head over to our website. It's ttbook.org. The pictures are really cool. Why has America stopped inventing? That's the provocative title of a book by Darren Gibby. Gibby's a patent lawyer and points out that Americans invent less than half of what we did a century ago. Half. Why? Are we less creative than we were 100 years ago? Gibby says the problem lies in one place and one place only. The U.S. patent system. He tells Anne Strainchamps the current system has got to go.
Well, the thing that was really frustrating to me was I'd see these inventors come into my office really exuberant, have some great ideas, and I was the one that was breaking the bad news to them to say, hey, look, you have a good idea, but in order for you to protect your idea, it's going to cost you around $30,000 to get your patent. It will take you about 5 years to work its way through the patent office. And then even worse, once you do get your patent, if anybody tries to copy your design and you need to bring a patent infringement suit, it's going to cost you $2 to $5 million to be able to stop them. Now, the ordinary American, these numbers are so large, it's impossible for anybody to do that. And without that kind of protection, there's really no way that they can come up with an invention and be able to successfully market it.
At this point, your poor inventor who walked in with his brilliant ideas scribbled on a napkin must be wondering how anyone ever built or made anything new or original in America. I mean, how did we get here? Have patents always been this hard to come by?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is no. It used to be relatively easy to get a patent. Back in 1836, they built a new patent office. They got a new patent commissioner whose name was Henry Ellsworth. His father was actually one of the Supreme Court justices. And they wanted to be able to come up with a system where the average American could quickly get a patent and be able to enforce it. And so the cost to get a patent in 1836 was about $30 to $40, and it took around 3 months. And then once you wanted to enforce your patent, the most expensive case back in the 1850s was handled by Daniel Webster while he was Secretary of State, handled the Goodyear rubber case, and he charged $10,000. People thought that was so outrageous that he could do that. But you look at how much it was then versus now, it almost seems trivial. And when you look at the numbers, back in the 1830s through the 1850s, America invented twice what it does now. I mean, that's a shocking statistic. We invented twice what we did now.
You make the comment in the book, you say that for these early inventors, inventing was their religion, meaning, you know, it wasn't just a hobby, it was an actual obsession. But I hear you sort of suggesting that inventing was a religion for America, too, that it was really a central part of the country's identity.
I really think it was. And if you look at the mid-19th century, everybody loved to invent. Everybody wanted a piece of the action. One of my favorite stories is with the Reaper case. Once they had invented the Reaper and it was out and all the farmers were using it, they would tinker with it all season long because it wasn't perfect. And what they would do is at the end of the season, they would take their ideas and they'd all file for patent applications. And McCormick was a genius at marketing. He lost his patent case, but he learned that the whole United States is my R&D department. So he would send out these patent scouts from his company at the end of each season. He would find the best inventions. He would buy them up. And then over the winter, he would incorporate them into his new model so that in the spring, he'd have a whole new line of Reapers. But the great part about this is the inventors were not part of his company. They were just average Americans doing what they do, which is inventing.
That makes me think of, there's a phrase I've heard, a patent troll.
Yeah, patent trolls are a real problem today. And what a patent troll is it's somebody who really doesn't have a business behind their company. They just go out and they buy up patents or they'll file for their own patents really without an idea. They'll just kind of put on paper some harebrained idea, work its way through the patent office, and then try to claim that it covers something that it doesn't. And most of these patent trolls today claim that they have patents that cover almost any kind of way to do business over the internet. And when you read these patents, you cannot understand what they're saying. But how these people operate is they know that it costs $2 to $5 million to defend against the lawsuit. So they'll sue hundreds of people at a time. They'll say, our patent covers your way of selling goods over the internet. And if you pay me, say, $50,000, we'll just settle the case right now. But if you don't settle, we're going to take you to trial and you're going to spend $2 to $5 million. And so most companies, they're held highway robbers. That's why they're called trolls, because it's cheaper to pay this guy $50,000 than to hire a law firm and spend $2 to $5 million.
You know, a lot of the stories you told from the early days of American invention, the Golden Age, are stories of individual guys who, on their own, with no particular equipment or giant lab or company behind them, just tinkered and worked until they came up with something. Charles Goodyear, Henry Ford, the Wright brothers. They didn't have big corporations behind them, but the picture I'm getting is that today you can't come up with a new invention or successfully defend it unless you've got the strength and the big pockets of a major corporation behind you.
Well, that's right. And there's two issues there. Is one, can you invent without a big corporation? And the second question is, do you need a big corporation to be able to move this through the patent system. And in answer to the first question, I think people can invent even without a big lab behind them. And a great example I saw in the New York Times a couple weeks ago was this woman who, while in high school, was at a VA hospital and saw this issue of referred pain with amputees from the war. And so she came up with this idea of being able to heat the limb when they had this referred pain so that it would get rid of it. And what she did is she wrote to a bunch of engineering universities and asked for help with her idea. And there was a number of them who were willing to help her out. And so now she's got this little company. She's going to go to law school. She knows nothing about technology, but she came up with the idea. Where we're really falling short is now we have these ideas. We need to protect them. We need to be able to move them on to where they can be brought into products. And that's really where our patent system has failed us.
Without getting too technical, can the system be fixed?
Oh, I think it can. And I think all that we have to do is go back to 1836 and the Patent Act that we had there, where it was so simple to get a patent application through the patent office and so simple to enforce it. What we've done in the 150 years since then, ironically, is that we've layered on doctrine after doctrine in an effort to make the system more fair. And while it may be somewhat more fair, it's just taken it out of the range of the ordinary inventor. So let's go back 150 years ago to what we had, what worked, and I think you would see the same groundswell of invention that you did back then.
Darren Gibby is the author of Why Has America Stopped Inventing? Anne Strainchance spoke with him. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In a recent interview with Wired magazine, Bill Gates said that if he were a teenager today, he would not be into computing. He'd be hacking biology. He said if you want to change the world in some big way, that's where you start. Biological molecules. Well, hacking biology, huh? It's not science fiction anymore. Welcome to the 21st century and the biopunk movement, where biohacking and kitchen table biotech are the norm. Steve Paulson sat down with journalist Marcus Wilson, author of Biopunk, to find out more about these DIY bioengineers. Like, is this legal?
Well, it certainly has attracted the attention of law enforcement, especially sort of when the movement kind of first self-identified, which I would say happened about 2008. It didn't take long for the FBI to come skulking around different events and getting in touch with people. As I researched this, what I found out is that it didn't really take the form of a crackdown because it isn't clear that the people, at least who are open about what they're doing, are doing anything illegal. The rules in the U.S., at least, are not as strict as you might think around doing at least kind of basic forms of genetic manipulation as they are in other countries where to do any kind of genetic engineering at all, you need to get a license from the government.
We should talk about some of the causes that the biopunks have embraced. For instance, going back to 2009 and the swine flu outbreak, the Centers for Disease Control announced that it would not reveal the genome sequence of the H1N1 virus. And this infuriated the biopunk movement. Why were they so upset about this?
Well, because their thinking goes that the more minds that you have attacking a problem, the more likely you are to solve that problem. And that's kind of the gospel of the open source software movement, which had some pretty strong successes. And not only is it sort of talking about, say, the Firefox web browser or something like that that nonprofits have developed, but you know, you look at a company like Google or a company like Twitter, you know, they open up their platforms to developers of all kinds. They give you a way to interface with the code so you can make new things. And biopunks look to that Silicon Valley model and they say, we should be able to do that too. And so when swine flu hit, there was this feeling of, well, why keep this closed off, especially because it's such a serious and urgent, or at least at the time seemed like a very serious and urgent need to figure out how to combat this, what people thought was going to possibly be a plague. Put it out there, let the wisdom of the crowd take its course, and maybe we'll solve this problem faster.
Well, let's talk about some of the people whom you've identified as biopunks. For instance, there is a self-taught bioengineer named Meredith Patterson. Tell me about her work.
Meredith was one of the first people I met, and in some ways she sort of fit exactly the image that you might think of somebody who you'd call a biopunk. She was a sort of tattooed, long trench coat wearing, purple hair, having quote-unquote hacker chick. And she had this idea of creating a biosensor, you might call it, using a little more than the bacteria that you can go buy at your grocery store that comes in a tub of yogurt. And what she and a couple colleagues were trying to figure out, and I use that term loosely, these are other people online who are part of the biohacker movement, they wanted to figure out a way to hack the genome of this yogurt bacteria to glow fluorescent green in the presence of a toxin that had been found in the dairy supply in China that had actually made a lot of children sick and even killed a few babies. That sounds incredibly, to me at least at the time, it sounded like an incredible sort of science fiction notion. But as it turns out, this gene that creates this protein that causes things to glow fluorescent is one of the sort of basic tools in biotech. And it exists in nature in jellyfish and in squid. And it's used as a kind of a signaler in all kinds of genetic engineering experiments. And so to actually get that gene into the genome of the yogurt bacteria, in a way, is the very simplest kind of tasks in genetic engineering, if you can call genetic engineering simple.
And then this woman, Meredith Patterson, went on to make something of a name for herself and actually wrote a biopunk manifesto.
That's right. It's really, in some ways, the clearest articulation of the ideals I was talking about of this movement. And Meredith represents sort of, you know, one facet of this movement where it really is about claiming your right to knowledge. That's certainly how she thinks about it. And in that way, she really embraces the DIY spirit, that knowledge is something that's out there that, you know, anyone with a brain should have a right to pursue. And if that means setting up a genetic engineering lab in your home, if you have the know-how and the desire, you shouldn't feel like you have to get somebody else's stamp of approval in order to do that.
You know, it's pretty exciting hearing about how some of these young, sometimes self-taught biopunks managed to do all of this. There's a potentially very dangerous side to all of this as well. I mean, we're talking about genetic engineering. We're talking about messing with some potentially dangerous viruses here. I mean, something could go very, very wrong, right?
In theory, that's right. Again, when you talk about a computer virus, ultimately that's a metaphor. When you're talking about biology, that virus is real. Now, what I've learned in following these folks around and talking to scientists and trying to understand this question around risk is that there really is a much greater likelihood that somebody messing around with genes in their house is going to simply end up with a failed experiment rather than something that could get into the water supply or float out the window and hurt people.
There's also a Dr. Frankenstein scenario here. I mean, the idea that genetically altered human beings are in our future. And I mean, that's certainly something that could conceivably be created in one of these dining room labs, right?
Well, anything's conceivable. Scientifically, not anytime soon. But I think what's interesting is that definitely among the biopunks, there's what I'd call a biolibertarian strain. And you hear talk about what they kind of see as a bias or a prejudice towards what's seen as natural. And this idea that there's a kind of baseline genetic profile that is the way nature intended something to be. And so they're really open. Some folks, I'm not going to say everyone, but some folks are very open to the idea of genetically manipulating ourselves and kind of a scenario where we, you know, have a tail, we have wings, we have a way of creating energy by genetically altering chlorophyll and it's under our skin and we don't have to eat anymore. You know, these are the kinds of ideas that science fiction writers play with. But science fiction has had a funny way of becoming science fact. So among this group of people, you definitely, I think, have an inclination among many towards this feeling that evolution is something that happens, and that if you look at the history of life, life is always changing. Now we have the ability to direct that evolution, and you know, we shouldn't be afraid of that.
Marcus Wolson's the author of Biopunk: DIY Scientists Hack the Software of Life. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Don't ask Anna Dietrich if she invented a car that can fly. No one can do that, she says. She did, however, invent a plane that can drive. It's called the Transition. This car-plane, or plane-car, whatever you call it, was dreamed up over beers with a bunch of fellow MIT students. The Transition's recent introduction at the 2012 New York International Auto Show was the talk of the town. Did Anna Dietrich have a moment where she just sat back and said, "Wow, I invented that"?
Unfortunately, no. One of the things that I like best about myself, and sometimes I regret most about myself, is I'm always very focused on what's next. So I very rarely take the time to step back and really just be like, oh my goodness, about anything. And it's much to the chagrin of the folks that talk with me and work with me about Terrafugia, because I'm always, you know, super proud of my team and very, you know, proud of the things that I've personally accomplished as well. But it's always, okay, great, check that off. Now what's next? So I don't know. I don't really remember a moment when I was truly in awe of the concept. I was like, oh, well, that's great. Now how do we do it?
I guess it's time for us to really talk about the Transition, this plane that you've designed. Or is it a car that you've designed?
It's a plane. It's an airplane that drives.
So what does it look like?
I always say that it looks like a car in the sky and a plane on the ground. So it has four wheels, traditional, you know, small airplane sort of configuration, wings. It's a low-wing aircraft, and it has twin tail booms. So it's a two-place aircraft. We have ours painted blue and white. And it just, you know, it looks, when it's parked on the ground, it looks, oh, it looks like an airplane. And then when we saw it in the air, we were like, oh, it really looks like a car in the air.
Can you describe for me the process of invention? Because you did have these two different and in some ways really opposing problems to deal with. On the one hand, you want a plane that is going to be at least meet the minimum standards of the best plane you can fly so you'll feel safe. And then the other equally difficult problem of designing the best plane you can drive.
Well, I think that's kind of a position that engineers really like to be in. given a hard problem and some interesting ways of solving it. And it doesn't have to start at an excruciatingly high level of detail, but you have to know what you're getting into. So, for instance, we had to know that this vehicle had to pass a certain set of crash tests before we really started doing any design work, because in order to solve that problem, it needs to be incorporated into your thinking from the beginning. You can't just complete something and then be like, oh, wait, but the structure of it has to pass this. Yeah. Right? So it's like you can't create the skeleton of the animal after you've already decided what shape the animal looks like, you know. So you have to know from the beginning what your requirements look like, at least at a detailed enough level to be thinking about them properly. Once you have that, we're a big fan of brainstorming at Terrafugia. We do it for everything, whether it's an engineering problem or a business problem or a marketing campaign. We always start with a brainstorming session. Basically, that's just getting as many smart people in the room that know a little bit about what you're trying to do as possible, laying out those ground rules and then saying go. And we're very strict about that. While you're actually officially brainstorming, you don't shoot down anybody's idea. You can make it better. You can build on it. But you can't say, oh, no, that won't work. So very collaborative, very camaraderie-focused environment for that.
Did you have two teams working on this, one focusing on driving, one focusing on flying?
Oh, no, that would have never worked. No. No offense, Jim, but that would have never worked.
Okay.
The vehicle's very integrated, and there's a lot of dual purpose in the structures and the mechanisms.
Now, takeoff and landing still must be done at a regulation airport, and not O'Hare, but a small landing field, right?
Yes. There's over 5,000 public use airports around the country. So on average, you're within about 30 miles of one at any point in the U.S.
And what about fuel for the Transition?
It runs on super unleaded autogas.
So you could actually pull into a gas station and put the hose into the tank and fill it up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have.
Do you have to build a bigger garage?
Well, it depends on you know, where you live and when the house is built. It's about 7 feet tall, a little bit less. So it will fit under a 7-foot garage door. And it's 90 inches wide. So if you could park sort of a larger SUV, like a Navigator and Escalade sort of style vehicle, you could probably park a Transition in your garage.
When you were younger, could you have imagined being involved in creating this?
No, I thought I was going to build spaceships. I always knew I wanted to work on things that flew. I did have stars in my eyes when I was a kid, but the reality of it is that aviation is much more open to individual entrepreneurship than space is today. And I hope that that's changing, and I think it is. But where we are now, this was the right industry for me to go do a company in.
You know, we've been interested in invention and in the ways people come up with new things. And we were looking back through patents. The very first one was for making potash, of all things. It's used in fertilizer. Signed by President George Washington in 1790. It's pretty practical when you think about it.
Yeah.
So here we are. It's 2012. Is the transition practical as you apply for a patent?
I don't know about potash, so I can't tell you if it's more or less practical than that. But it is practical. And one of the things that we've been demonstrating with our test program now is that it is also real. So if you watch the video that we've released with it, you know, driving through the neighborhood and pulling into the gas station and taking off from the airport, the thing that still strikes me about it is just how normal it all looks. Well, of course, he's getting gas. What's the big deal? And then you realize that, well, he's getting gas and he's going to go fly it in about 15 minutes. So I think it is practical. It does work, which, you know, I do feel like given the science fiction connotations that flying cars tend to have, it does need to be emphasized. This is a real thing. You can really use it. And I think it's going to have a real practical impact on a lot of people's lives.
Anna Dietrich invented the Transition, a plane that can drive. To see the Transition in action, or if you have $279,000 to spare and want one of your own, go to our website at ttbook.org or at Facebook. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking to American inventors. Our next guest is inventing a new music genre. His name is Robert Glasper, and he's a Grammy-nominated jazz pianist. He's also the musical director for the rappers Q-Tip and Mos Def. And he's the pianist for R&B singer Maxwell. In his own work, he brings all those genres together into a new form, and I'm not sure what you call it. Glasper calls his new album Black Radio. He tells Steve Paulson it's a reference to the black box of recordings that survives a plane crash.
I named the album Black Radio because I feel like when music crashes around you, good music always survives. You can always go back to great music, no matter what's happening on the radio stations or whatnot. So I named this album Black Radio because I feel like this is one of those albums that will survive amongst all the crashing and burning that's going around us.
So you think music basically is in pretty sad shape right now?
I think so. I think at least the music that is put in front of everyone's faces is. You know what I mean? The music that normally makes the Billboard charts are. You know what I mean?
Well, and you're even in your liner notes, you're even stronger about that. I mean, you say the collective dumbing down of our music is the greatest tragedy we can impose on generations to follow.
Indeed. And that's the truth. Because that's what they're holding as gold now. These certain songs, these, you know, I'm in the club, I'm shaking my ass. You know, I got guns. You know, it's just every song is about that. Look at my cars. You know, it's like five subjects that you have to be talking about in order to make mainstream radio now.
Are you talking specifically about hip hop here?
Hip hop and R&B. In order to make an R&B song that's gonna be on the top of the charts, it's still the same subjects. You know what I mean? It's still talking about some of the same things. The music has to be a certain way, has to be a certain formula, you know what I mean? And if you're a girl, you have to be somewhat of a Beyonce, you know. You can't just be a talented vocalist with a really good song.
You got to look a certain way, too.
You got to look a certain way. You got to dance. You got to, it's just a whole package, and everybody has to be that. So every record label is searching for the same person to compete with the other same person.
So where do you come into this then? I mean, as someone who loves music but doesn't like a lot of the most popular music out there, how do you?
I just do what I like to do, and I love jazz, and I'm a jazz pianist, and then I also love R&B and hip hop, which, that's my whole thing. I've always been in both sides of that world. I'm a Blue Note recording artist, and I've played in Christian McBride's band and Kenny Garrett's band and Russell Malone and Roy Hargrove and Terrence Blanchard. But at the same time, I'm also Maxwell's piano player and recorded and played with Q-Tip, and I'm Mos Def's music director, and I do that side too. So I just love music. So I put together a record that I just think is just good music. And lo and behold, it debuted at number 4 on the hip hop R&B charts, right after Rihanna. And that doesn't happen. So I was number 1 on the jazz charts and number 4 on hip hop R&B charts. So my point was to cross over, in doing this record, doing a record that kind of flirts with a lot of different styles. But it also did it on Billboard as well, to my surprise. In a heart, you're in a mind. You're the star that will always shine. Forever you'll be with me.
You ever see the inner depths of a man's soul? Or Ninja Turtles pouring out of manholes? It's this balance between the comic and the conscious that's the challenge. Between the solitary and the conference that I examines, that I imagine once a figure will be the start of world peace and the transformation of niggas. Like the transubstantiation of liquor, but that's just turning them into blood. And we'll be right back where we was. Not a peace sign, but a fascination with scissors. So I can cut myself off from the calculations of empress empires and the centers for advancement and human suffering and other things trying to impede my publishing.
I just want to be. I just want to be. Some people in the jazz world are probably saying, oh, he sold out or something. You're selling out. You're doing this hip hop stuff. But actually, I'm being honest. I'm of the hip hop generation. So I'm doing what's within my generation. So actually, I'm not selling out. I'm being honest. Me not being honest would be selling out.
I have to ask about this crossover because, I mean, this is a fascinating collection of music that you're drawing from on this album. I mean, you have David Bowie tunes, Nirvana, as well as the classic jazz standard Afro Blue. I mean, it raises the question, what holds all this music together?
I mean, the honest love for it, for me. I mean, I grew up, my mother was a singer, piano player, and she listened to so much music, different, all kinds of different music, you could walk in the house, one minute you're listening to Liza Minnelli, the next minute you're listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Oscar Peterson, then you're listening to Mahalia Jackson, then you're listening to, Phil Collins or Billy Joel and Bruce Hornsby. The list just goes on and on. So I've always been a fan of just all kinds of music. I think what holds it together is having a band that also has that same eclectic taste in music and who can also play all that kind of stuff in a fashion that's comfortable and effortless. So it brings everything across in a very honest and effortless and casual way versus it sounding like we're trying to be cool by doing these songs. When in fact, I've loved Nirvana since I was in sixth grade. You know what I mean? And I've loved Teen Spirit, that specific song, Smells Like Teen Spirit, for that long as well. You know what I mean? So it's just, I'm just really being honest of what I like. It's just that, people don't expect you to like certain things, I guess.
How would you describe your version? Is this jazz? Is this rock?
It's a bunch of stuff in one. I think it's a more laid-back urban approach, especially towards the end. it gets there. It turns into more of an R&B slow jam out of nowhere, which I love, because it literally comes out of nowhere. And it wasn't even planned that way. We just kind of happened that way. And Layla just happened to be in the studio while we were recording that song. So I was like, hey, come sing on it. Hmm. You know what I mean? So I feel like, yeah, it's just it's the urban version of Teen Spirit, speaking to everyone, just like the original was, just in a different way that everybody can hear it.
So what is it about the way jazz is usually played that you don't like then? I mean, do you feel like it's too stuck in the past?
Way too stuck in the past. It's when you listen to a lot of jazz nowadays, they're drawing from 1960 and before. They make that their whole thing. And the thing that's different is those cats weren't doing that. The cats in 1960 were not drawing from, you know, 80 years before them. You know what I mean? They were playing what was fresh, cool, and hip at that moment. Like, that was the hip-hop of its day. Mm. We now are drawing from the past and kind of making the past our present in some way. And that's not what our founding fathers of the music had in mind.
Let's talk about what you do. And just to cite one example, actually, from a previous album, Mood, you have an arrangement of Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage, which features vocals from the hip-hop artist Bilal. And you're also sampling on piano the Radiohead song Everything in Its Right Place.
Right.
Which raises the question, what is this? I mean, is this jazz, this song? Is it hip-hop? Does it matter?
It's jazz, because jazz takes from its surroundings and makes something new. It's like a casserole. You know, they take a bunch of old things that are lying around and new things that are lying around, and you make a new meal. It's casserole. Mm. That's what, you know, John Coltrane did with My Favorite Things. Nobody listens to My Favorite Things by John Coltrane and says that's not jazz, because My Favorite Things is not a jazz tune. My Favorite Thing is a show tune. Mm-hmm. You know, that's from The Sound of Music. And he took that and was like, hey, I like that song. It's not a jazz song, but I'm going to make it into one because I like it. That's what John Coltrane did. And everyone's like praising it now. Oh my God, it's amazing. It's in all the jazz books, you know? Mm-hmm. But it takes people like that to keep jazz alive and keep it growing. You know, you have to take things that are around you and you have to tell your own story. I can't tell the story of somebody in 1950. That's why those songs don't do anything for me. I love Body and Soul. I love playing Body and Soul. It doesn't touch me like something else might that's of this generation. You know what I mean? I didn't grow up with Body and Soul. I didn't cry to Body and Soul. I didn't get my heart broken to Body and Soul. You know, and those people did.
You're ruling the way that I move, and I breathe your air. You only can rescue me.
We've been talking about some of the great singers who were featured on your album Black Radio. One of them is Erykah Badu, who sings the classic Afro Blue. Tell me about that choice.
Ever since I've heard Erykah Badu's voice, I've always thought she sounded like a reincarnated Billie Holiday. You know, she's embodied that. It's not even like she's trying. It just is. So in my mind, I've always heard her singing jazz. I've never heard her sing jazz before, but in my mind, she sings jazz all the time. So when I asked her to be on the record, and I've always loved this song, Afro Blue, and for me, her and Afro Blue go hand in hand. She even thanked me for turning her on to this song after the fact. She's like, oh my God, thank you. I love this song. I don't know why I've never heard it, you know. So when I did this arrangement, I did it specifically for her, and she loves flutes. Mm-hmm. You know, so I specifically made this arrangement just for her, and it came off so great. She's so natural. Rich as the night, Afro Blue. There's a million good singers, you know, there's a million technical singers, there's a million technical piano players, you know, but who has a sound, you know, who sounds like themselves, who has a story is what I'm looking for, you know what I mean, and everybody on this album has that. At the end of the day, I don't care what you're saying, if I can't listen to your voice, I don't want to hear you talk. You know, sound is the first thing you hear. It's the video audio. It's the first thing you hear is sound, then after that, oh, they sound, oh, what are they saying? Oh, they can sing really good. But the first thing you hear is the sound of their voice. And everybody on this album, if they all just say, la, you know who they are.
The Robert Glasper Experiments album is called Black Radio. Steve Paulson spoke with him. To see a beautiful performance of the Robert Glasper Experiments cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit live from the public radio studios at WNYC, just go to our Facebook page or our website at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on American Invention, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find some amazing past interviews. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.